investigating an unsolved murder from 20 years ago, on the other side of the world, well, it's had a bigger impact on me than I thought it would. My sleep patterns have changed. I'm now waking up in the middle of the night to check my emails, see if there's any news. And I'm constantly pulling at new theories, getting annoyed with myself that nothing seems to make sense. So it's fair to say that I've come to expect the unexpected. But a few months into my investigation, I received an email which changed everything.
And this is posted on Wednesday, December the 27th. So this is 3 days before the murder. And he says, "I want to cut through humans and see their internal organs." It is wild.
From What's the Story Sounds and USG Audio, this is Faceless, Episode 6. I've gone over articles and reports on this case time and time again. Sometimes I'm halfway down the page and I'm getting excited before I realise it's something I already know. There's only a handful of reports in English, so I've been asking Ryushi to translate everything, and something has jumped out. In the original reports, the killer is described as being 5'6" tall, slight build, and between 15 and 35 years of age. But in some of the more recent reports, that description has changed. The killer is described, still, as 5'6", slight build. But he's reported as being younger, between 15 years old and early 20s. Now, the first time I heard that, I assumed it was a mistake. That's so young. Surely the killer could not have been 15. That would rule out any kind of military link for a start, and discount the idea that he was a Korean hitman too. By going through the records, it turns out the change happened in 2016. That's when the police revised their estimate, aging the suspect down to between 15 and 20s. I asked Takeshi Tsuchita, the former police chief who led this case, why that change had come about. Why was it they thought the killer had been so young?
Based on the killer's clothing and his positions, like the hip bag, etc., the age range was originally stated by the TMPD to be 15 to 35. However, it was later reported in some news that this age range was 15 to 24. The reason that they narrowed it down to 15 to 20s is that the people who use marker pens are mainly university students.
Highlighter pens. In the hip bag which the killer was wearing, alongside the grains of sand and fiberglass-type material linked to skateboarding, the police found residue from highlighter pens. And they deduced that these pens were the sort students would use. The age of the suspect had been lowered because of the presence of a pen.
I'm not totally satisfied with this explanation. But currently, the age range is said to be 15 to maximum 30 years old.
Now, this is one of the strangest details I've learned so far, because the chief had all but ruled out the bag being relevant, insisting it could belong to someone else. So how could it be that the bag was now being used to change the very description of the suspect? That feels like a disconnect to me. Early on in my investigation, I spoke to criminal psychologist Professor David Cantor, asking him what sort of person the faceless man could be. And he actually talked about age.
Teenagers typically are impulsive, potentially opportunistic. Obviously some teenagers are physically very strong, but the physicality you describe in terms of the entry into the house and what was going to be needed to control people all suggests meet somebody a bit older. It's remarkable how common it is that murderers are in the early to mid-20s, typically. It seems to be a stage in life at which people are either beginning to get some understanding of who they are and what their life is about, or of feeling their life is coming unstuck in various ways. And the most extremes of criminal activity often occur in that time in the early 20s. And that would be my very rough and ready guess about the individual we're talking about here.
Now, I was really surprised. I'd always pictured the killer as a grown man, older. That just made sense to me.
But David Cantor and the Tokyo police had left the door open to it being a younger man, though maybe not as young as a teenager.
Still, there were things which leaned into this younger theory, and not just highlighter pens. Things like the ice creams, which the suspect had eaten from the freezer. And don't forget the idea that floated around after his waste in the toilet had been analysed, that he had eaten a home-cooked style meal, quote, like mother might make. Theory number 6, the teenager. The killer is a teenager living in Japan who has the urge to commit murder and who has stayed under the radar thanks to his age.
Initially, I wasn't sold on this theory.
But then I was contacted by someone I had reached out to early on in my journey, a translator and writer in Poland called Magda Szymanska.
Nick? Hey Magda, how are you doing?
Hi.
She was writing an article at the time about the Setagaya murders, and we'd been talking about the case. She promised to let me know if she came across anything significant. 9 months later, and here she was, sending me an email, which simply read, "I think I've found something."
So I got your message saying that you had you found something and that we should have a look. So you sent me an email, right?
Yeah. It's a blog. It might be useful to you.
Uh-huh.
This blog that Magda was telling me about, she hadn't really leaned on it while writing her article, as she was working from official sources only. But knowing that I wanted to explore every possible lead, she shared it with me. The blog is called The Loser's Howling, Considerations of the Setagaya Murders. It's hosted on a Japanese blog site. And it was pages and pages of content, over 100 posts, from an anonymous author, all of them dedicated to this one case.
This is kind of blowing my mind a bit because
yeah.
It goes back to January of 2015. Now, in that month, he seems to, whoever this person is, he or she, who's running this blog, they post 14 times, it seems. And then the next month, it's 13, and then it goes down a bit. But I mean, he last posts in, what is that, in June of this year. So, I mean, that's kind of crazy that he has that much to say about this case every month consistently for the last, you know, 5-6 years. So sorry, Magda, what was the thing that you were saying you wanted to bring to my attention? Because I know there's this blog, but was there anything specific about this blog that jumped out at you?
There was just this one post which I've never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen this information before. So if you scroll right to it's the last post at the bottom of the page.
Okay.
So
I did what Magda said. I scrolled and I scrolled, and there, at the bottom, was a screen grab of a forum post which the blogger had found. It had been posted on a popular Japanese forum called 2chan, and it was apparently written just a few days before the Miyazawa murders.
So it's posted by a guy called Mr. Kurumutsu, right?
Yes.
And this is posted on Wednesday, December the 27th. So this is 3 days before the murder. And he says, "I have been a crow since I was a 3-year-old kid." What does that mean, "I have been a crow"?
Since he was 3 years old, he started killing mice.
Mm.
And then sometimes he even fed them to crows or birds.
Mm-hmm.
Crow, it seems, means predator. The forum post is saying he's been killing animals from a very early age.
So, and I keep doing this even now when I'm 13. So then he said that he remembers that when he was 7, he also killed a dog, and it gave him a great pleasure to see this dog die.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, what he says that he wants to try doing this with humans.
I mean, this guy, he essentially, this post, the first half of it is just his kind of history of killing and maiming animals. He goes into a great deal of detail. And then, like you say, at the end of it, he then says, recently I want to cut through humans and see their internal organs. Just like the boy suspected of the video shop bombing incident in Kabukicho. And now when I see a happy family next door, I want to make it look like the murder of the Oita family, which is a family also killed by a miner, right? And then he then says, the date of the event is 11:59 p.m. on December 31st. I'm thinking about killing them before the 21st century arrives. So he's, it sounds like, making a plan to kill a family before the new year comes in.
This is Wild, a forum post on a Japanese website, 2chan, written 3 days before the Miyazawa murders, essentially predicting the massacre of a family. What are the odds of guessing something like this in essentially the safest major city in the world? So, the poster writes a detailed confessional, admitting to harming animals, saying he wants to go further, graphically explaining how he wants to cut through human flesh, and talking about being inspired by other high-profile murders in Japan committed by miners. Now, when I read this, a big part of me couldn't help but feel that this was written by the killer. We tried to verify the existence of the post on 2chan, and we couldn't find it. But former police chief Takeshi Tsuchita did confirm to us that it was genuine. And it's the most remarkable piece of evidence I never thought I'd uncover. And what makes it all the more extraordinary is that the 2chan poster says his age is 13.
But I mean, I suppose what's clear is that there was a guy three days before the Miyazawa murders who says he wants to kill a family. Like, that's definitely a thing that happened. That post was real. Whether or not the guy who did it was the killer or not is a different matter. But it does seem to be, at the very least, a coincidence. Okay, so let's pretend, like I say, let's pretend for 1 second that whoever writes this post is telling the truth, right? That they have been killing animals, and that they are indeed a neighbour of a happy family.
I looked into it, and there it was. Right there in the news. Around the year 2000, a series of cat killings in Setagaya, 13 of them, causing local residents and visitors to the park to panic. In one of the articles, there's a quote from a criminal psychologist, Akira Fukushima. Quote, "The abuse points to an individual whose tendency is to victimise the weak. The possibility of such acts escalating to a random assault targeting, in particular, children and women, should not be dismissed." I got off the call with Magda and my brain was fried. Who had written that blog post? And had they killed the Miyazawa family? The next morning, I called Ryushi and gave him the news about the blog.
Ryushi, how you doing? You good?
Hey man, yeah, good. How are you?
Well, I'm pretty excited, to be honest with you. I mean, I don't know if this is fool's gold or what, but I've been sent something. It's a blog. To be honest with you, I don't know how I didn't find it before, but I'm pretty excited because there seems to be a lot on it which I haven't seen before. It's actually, I'm going to send you the link now. It's actually all about this case. It's all about the Setagaya case. From what I can make out, it's just a guy who's blogging only about this case. So I want to send that to you. Hold on.
I wanted Ryushi to find out everything he could about these Miyazawa posts and to track down who the mysterious person behind the blog was. Why did they care so much about the case? Were they somehow involved? And what did they make of the claim that the killer had been just 13 years old?
If nothing else, here is a guy who is blogging quite frequently for the last few years about one topic. So maybe it's the one guy who's as obsessed with this as I am. So I think we need to find him.
All right, let me take a look. Just glancing at his blog, it's all anonymous and he has no contact form. So
of course.
Let me see what I can find, eh?
While Ryushi went away to find out more about this mysterious blog, I kept thinking about the possibility that the killer had been a young teenager. It was just so strange, hard to imagine. So, who was this so-called Mr. Kudomutsu? In his 2chan post, he mentions two other crimes that, quote, inspired him. He talks about the boy behind the Kabukicho video store bombing and the Oita family murders. So, what clues do they hold? On Monday, December 4th, 2000, a 17-year-old boy walked into a video store in the busy entertainment district of Kabukicho in Tokyo and detonated a homemade bomb. Nobody was hurt, but the store was extensively damaged. The boy then walked into a nearby police station and handed himself in. When he was searched, officers found another bomb, as well as a shotgun and 39 shells. The young man was prosecuted, but to this day, there's little detail on why he did it. The Oita family murders, however, well, they're more notorious. In August 2000, 4 months before the murders in Setagaya, a 15-year-old boy attacked a family of six as they slept in their home in Oita, which is about 600 miles west of Tokyo. He broke into the house at 2 a.m., armed with a knife, murdered three, and left three more with serious injuries. Now, the boy was soon arrested, and he told police he did what he did because the family had accused him of being a peeping Tom. All right, so was the so-called Kudomutsu, our 13-year-old internet poster on 2chan, inspired to copy these crimes in Oita? The Miyazawa murders certainly have some of the same hallmarks. Family home, an intrusion in the middle of the night, a knife, and extreme levels of violence. And the Oita murders were the latest in an unusual string of violent acts perpetrated by minors. In a country which hadn't experienced high levels of youth crime, the start of the year 2000 marked a worrying trend. So, in that context, maybe it wasn't so improbable that the faceless man could be a faceless boy.
Hey Ryushi, you good?
Hey, yeah, keeping busy. Yourself?
Well, you know me in my little bunker. Now, I got your message, and I don't want to get my hopes up too much, but you say there's some news.
Yeah, well, listen, Nick, I was looking, I was looking for that blogger for you. And like I said last time, I was looking through, I clicked through hundreds of articles on his blog. There's no contact form. There's no email address. And I even left a comment on there, but never heard back. But I did actually find a link to another blog. Turns out it's written by the same guy, and I managed to connect that with a Twitter account.
Oh, wow.
So I slid into his DMs, and
right.
He wants to stay anonymous, but he's willing to talk to us.
All right. So, like, who is this guy? What's his deal?
Man, I don't know. He didn't reveal much about himself. All I know is he's a Japanese guy living in Japan. I didn't even get a name. He just goes by this pseudonym, Monazite. but he has agreed to meet me in person. So we're setting that up for next week.
Monazite. What kind of a name is that? Still, I'm pleased he wants to talk to me, and I'm intrigued. What's his connection to this case, and why is he writing so much about it? A few days later, Emryushi travelled to a small house in Shibuya, Tokyo, and waited for Monazite to arrive. I was set up via video link, and I looked on as Monazite, casually dressed in hoodie and jeans, took a seat and got mic'd up.
I guess my first question, just purely out of curiosity, is why the name Monazite, if we can ask that? I'm just, for my own curiosity.
最初の質問なんですけども、まず簡単にモナザイトはなぜモナザイトさんっていうお名前で活動されてるんでしょうか。この事件を調べるとちょっとモナザイト出てくるんです。So
if you look into the case, a word that comes up as you're reading about it is monozite, and this is a particle that was found in the killer's hip bag.
Monazite told me that he didn't have any kind of morbid fascination with this case. In actual fact, he's a sports journalist, living and working in Japan, who just happened upon this, and he started digging. And I mean, who am I to judge? The exact same thing happened to me.
The reason I became interested in this case was that in 2014, usually at the end of the year, there is like a special of the 10 greatest unsolved cases in Japan. I happened to watch this, and this is where the case was mentioned. And that's where I initially started to become interested in the case. Before that, I had no interest in it at all. This is a case that has invited so many theories about it, and there is no clear motive. And so I really wanted to sort my own thought about it as well, and wanted to sort of try and come up with some sort of answer.
We talked for nearly 2 hours, and the key thing I wanted to know was how trustworthy all his claims and blog posts were. Monazite told me that everything he posted was verified.
I mainly use newspapers and magazines. I try to use sources as I consider to be accurate. So, sources that are members of the police press club, for example, of press clubs and also TV media too. And I look at this reporting, and then I assess it and think about this sort of through my own eyes. I never sort of speculate. I don't sort of indulge in sort of empty speculation without any sources. I never come up with sort of unsourced ideas. I always try and look for some sources for what I'm writing about.
Of all of the posts and claims on Monazite's blog, it was the 2chan post from the 13-year-old that I wanted to know more about.
This comment was left on 2chan immediately before the murders, and this supposedly written by a 13-year-old boy, and he writes about wanting to kill this family. Personally, I think that the motive was sort of a pleasure killing, a murder for fun, and this would match with this comment on 2chan. So personally, I think that this would fit the motive. I think this was a pleasure killing. And at the time, the generation that turned 17 that year, actually, that whole generation, for some reason or other, was particularly involved in crime. There were a lot of people from that generation who committed crime. And I think even if the killer was older, then this may be he was influenced by this generation. Maybe he wanted to kill. Maybe he wanted to try killing someone. Maybe he left these 2chan comments, or maybe he saw them. I don't know who the killer was. Everyone with a direct link to the Miyazawa family has been investigated. So really, there can only be someone with some sort of very indirect connection. Perhaps someone who saw them in the park, something like that. But at the time, in the area, there were a lot of animals that were being killed. And maybe the family saw him killing or torturing an animal, Or maybe it was someone who takes pleasure from torturing and killing the weak, whether that's animals or whether that's children and women. This is the sort of profile I imagine the killer to have. But looking at this killing, and you compare it with other murder cases around the world, it really matches this sort of killing for pleasure. And these sort of murders are rare in Japan.
Monazite knew a lot about the case, but now I wanted a professional view. I went back to Professor David Cantor and told him about the 2chan post, the 13-year-old cat killer who had made a prediction about killing a family. And he wasn't sold.
If you thought you were going to get away with it, and it was something that was really a part of you, then you wouldn't tell anybody. But if you did announce it beforehand, you'd want to tell the world that you'd done it. I mean, he's announced that he's been killing animals. Surely he would want people to know that he killed the family. It could well be that killing animals gave him enough of a taste of what was involved and what the issues were, that was enough to act out his sort of fantasy or his desires. People can be very strange, so you can never rule anything out in terms of the complexity of human behavior. But as you've suggested, it seems remarkable that for a start, a teenager could be away from home for that length of time. And as I've said, the actual statement online is, it's a bit like these people who write really angry letters to others, threatening them in all sorts of ways. What we've found is it's very rare for those threats to be followed through.
Not for the first time, a promising lead was turning out to be less and less viable. So far during this investigation, we've identified 6 very different theories. The Korean national, the hired hitman, the disgruntled skater, the military link, the 3 killers, and the teenager. But before we go on, I want to quickly tell you about 2 other reports. Another 2 theories which you should know about, just so you have the full picture. In October 2019, a Japanese magazine named a suspect in the murder of a doctor in Tokyo. They claimed that the attacker was a Chinese national, Guo. And bizarrely, they reported that this Guo shared his DNA with that of the faceless man, and the police were now searching for him. But there is one more remarkable detail here. Guo was listed as being 33 years old, which would have made him 13 at the time of the murders. But while I've tried to join the dots and find out more about this mysterious Guo, there's nothing. The attack on the doctor was real. He was stabbed in the neck and almost died. But there's nothing else to corroborate the idea that Guo was behind it. And if the DNA was a match, well, the Tokyo police have done some job of keeping that detail quiet. You'd expect a worldwide manhunt if there was a name to match to a profile of the killer. And yet, there's been nothing. The second recent report is a more intriguing tale. It comes from a Japanese journalist whose neighbour was visited by Tokyo police. They wanted to ask some questions. Now, this was pretty recent, just 1 year ago. But this neighbour, called Mr. A, wasn't a skater, and he knew nothing about the Miyazawa murders. He had, at the time of the murders, simply owned a yakiniku restaurant in Setagaya. Police visited because they were following a lead. A lead about a former employee. According to reports, Mr. A had employed a kitchen clerk, who would by now be in his 40s, and who we know only by a single letter, H. The day after the murders came to light, H was seen by a frequent customer of the restaurant while walking her dog in the Soshigaya district. And get this, H had a bandaged hand. Unfortunately, Mr. A closed down his restaurant a few years after the Setagaya murders, and there is no resume or star photo for this H. Now, I should say that neither one of these two last reports made the major news outlets, or at least so far as I can see, let alone international ones. But I mention them both because they tell me two things. Number one, the police are still actively making inquiries. And number two, the media is still readily reporting on any rumour, twist or turn. Maybe there's some truth to these latest reports. While I have my doubts, I guess there's as much hope here as anywhere else. The faceless man could be a military guy. He could be an opportunist burglar. He could have been a teenager. And he could, I guess, have been a Korean hitman. He might have disappeared into the woods and been eaten by the bears. Or he might have been an angry skater. Any of these theories are possible. But we've been dealing in possibility for so long. So let's talk about what is definitive. My conclusion is that there is a way to know for sure who did this. For one step forward, to not be one back. To solve this case once and for all. And that comes back to the DNA. This podcast was written and hosted by me, Nick Obregón. My producers for What's the Story Sounds are Daryl Brown and Sophie Ellis. In Japan, my producer is Ryushi Lindsay. Sound design by Tom Bruins. Our music is composed by James Warburton and KPM Music. Our USG audio team includes Josh Block and Jennifer Sears. This is a USG audio podcast in collaboration with What's the Story Sounds. If you have any information or leads on this case, please email faceless@whatsthestorysounds.com or reach out to us on Twitter. And if you've enjoyed this series, please leave us a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. And check out more USG audio podcasts at usgaudio.com.